Hi, welcome to the URN Pulse Show this Thursday. We will be speaking about Boris Johnson's top aide quitting, university's reaction to the travel window, England's test and trace system being hit by a huge IT problem last month, and finally the BBC's pay discrimination being branded a whitewash. You are joined today by Chinakshi, Lilith and Tamara. So first, I'd like to speak about England's test and trace system had a huge IT problem last month, and it was caused huge delays in calls, sorry about that, for the most vulnerable coronavirus patients last month. Sources said the previously undisclosed problems led to delays of up to 48 hours in reaching potentially infected people linked to care homes and hospitals. The government's scientific advisors have said 80% of an infected person's close contacts should be reached within 24 hours to stem the spread of the disease. The IT failure happened in mid-October when the number of infections and people in hospital were rising exponentially across large parts of the UK. They will add to concerns that the £12 billion system has failed to keep up with the second wave, which it was supposed to help prevent. So what do you two think about this so far and this failure that happened last mid-October? Were you two particularly affected by it? Or
I think it's quite worrying that this failure happened, because especially like here in Nottingham, like COVID cases were rising, especially among the student population. And with the IT failure, that probably made it a lot worse. Like, if people weren't getting contacted in the way that they should have been.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think there's been issues with this from the very start. And I've always been one of those skeptics, not for the fact that there's probably some big conspiracy or anything of that sort, but just because I just don't think we have the IT foundations to make this work, because I just feel like we keep getting reminded about how much we invested in this system, but all I'm hearing is how much it's failed. So I've been pretty skeptical from the outset, really.
No, same. I've also been skeptical, like giving my information to like the NHS testing trace app, because I don't really want to be under surveillance under the government, if that makes sense. Also,
yeah,
scary. Yeah. Emails were sent to the NHS clinical level contact tracers on the 15th and 16th of October that said huge IT issues were being worked upon at the highest level. The problems, they emerged on the 15th of October when an email was sent to the NHS clinical professionals that said, "We are aware of huge IT issues today. They've been raised to the PHE sites." The emails also said that there were issues with tier 3 contact escalations getting stuck in the system and with outbreak cases that require contact tracing, which the latter part of what I was speaking about, that's quite dangerous, because what they're basically saying is that they were having trouble finding people who were carriers of the coronavirus disease and those were who were most susceptible to like transfer it to other people. And so this IT failure basically allowed for more transmission and the spread of coronavirus to happen even more.
That's really worrying to like hear when cases are rising so much, and we're now in second lockdown, and it's like, was this failure a direct cause of this second lockdown? Like, if this hadn't happened, if we had more effective test and trace system, would we not have to be in a second lockdown right now? Or how impactful has this been? And I think that there have been a lot of failures over the past how many months it is now, 9 months. And I think we need to start getting to the root cause of why a lot of these things are happening.
Definitely. I think as well, part of the problem is this is going to make it really hard to come out of this lockdown on the other end of things. I just think people are going to be even more sceptical, even more concerned. And I think it's actually going to have an adverse effect, because people will be less willing to even use the app or use any form of contact tracing, even like writing their details down manually. I just think people are going to be entirely put off because they've lost all their faith in it. So even once we get through this lockdown 2.0, I kind of worry how we're going to get out of it the other side, because surely we'll see cases flaring up again, and presumably we still won't have a reliable contact tracing app.
No, I completely agree. And statistics released from the whole scandal show that only 43.6% of close contacts were reached by the system in the week up to the 21st of October, compared with 67% of the following week. So that's basically showing that less than half of the actual contacts were actually contacted by the NHS or kept under scrutiny, which understandably led to this second lockdown. So, like, what do you guys feel about the knowledge that it's not necessarily people who have been travelling that have risen to this second lockdown, but it's actually been the failures of this test and trace system that have resulted in this, especially knowing that it's been like paid like £82 million by the government for it to work?
I think it's sort of ridiculous that these failures are continuing to happen, but then the government keep acting like at some point we'll be back to normal when we still don't have an effective test and trace system.
Yeah.
But then today on the news they were saying, like, Rishi Sunak said that he wouldn't rule out doing a winter eat out to help out, even though the one in summer did actually lead to an increase in cases. So I think that the fact that they're already talking about measures like that without having an effective test and trace system is a complete failure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
43.6%, like, that's not even reaching the halfway mark.
It isn't.
That's a really, really poor number. And it's just, like you say, the amount we've invested in this. And we keep hearing as well in the news about all of these people that are struggling, have fell through the gap in terms of furlough or receiving any funding. And you think, you know, for that amount of money, you'd hope something would work. And it makes you wonder, could the money have actually gone somewhere else?
No, absolutely. How do you guys think about students being made the scapegoat of this whole national lockdown, and for it to actually reveal that it's actually the system that's failed?
I think it was very easy to use students as a way of having someone to blame. I feel like they've just been changing groups of who to blame throughout this entire time. And I think, yeah, there's going to be students who aren't following lockdown, and like, that's going to happen everywhere. In the same that will happen in any group of people. And in any group, you'll have people who are following the rules too perfectly, and you'll have people who aren't following the rules at all. And I think we need to stop looking at individual, well, especially the government needs to stop looking at individual groups to blame and start looking at the facts and start looking at what they need to do to actually make things effective and the best way to implement things, and to stop ignoring the scientists and then implementing things weeks after they were told they should have.
Yeah.
No, I definitely agree. I think we were only used as scapegoats, as you say, so that the government had someone to point the finger at. But I think it's so unfortunate because we're all suffering just because a small minority of students might be flouting some of the rules. And I think that we are being targeted, because I think the reason why they're handing out these hefty fines to us was really just to deter the rest of us, because they thought we were going to be the ones more likely to break the rules. But actually, the people who I've seen breaking most of the rules and people having these mass anti-lockdown protests are actually people who are far removed from our own demographic. So it's quite ironic, really.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, thanks you two for speaking about that. After this song, we will be speaking about university students reacting to the travel window and mass testing. Thank you for joining. Now we were speaking about the university students and their reactions to the government announcing the travel window and mass testing led by Tamara.
Yeah, so university students in England we've been given the guidance that students will be able to travel home between the 3rd and 9th of December for Christmas. So students who want to go home for Christmas are advise that they should be going home within this period between the 3rd and the 9th. Universities, including the University of Nottingham, will also be conducting mass testing of students and through their own system, in order to make sure that students aren't going home whilst testing positive for COVID. This is a new announcement that came out yesterday under government guidance, and in Nottingham, we've also received emails and information already about this period of happening. But I wanted to ask the panel, so the term in Nottingham got extended by another week, so our Christmas holidays was only meant to be 3 weeks long. So the term's not meant to end until the 18th of December here. Is it good enough that everything will be going online from the 9th of December when our term is not meant to end for another, let's say, 2 weeks, whilst, and instead of getting in-person teaching as we currently are, we will be getting online teaching?
I really don't like that, simply because what we are paying for isn't the quality of teaching that we're actually receiving. I don't want to pay 9.2k for online teaching and online classes, and I'm really grateful that I even have these in-person classes. So I think that them deciding to move everything on online, it just sucks, because I don't want it. I'm sure there are some other people who don't want it, and I think the government kind of made this decision without consulting universities.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a big split on this front, I believe, because I think a lot of students were going to be going home regardless, and a lot of students are at home. They, as soon as lockdown was announced, they thought they may as well go home if they're more comfortable there. So I think a lot of students have and will do so anyway before the end of term. Right, and I also think a lot of students have adapted to this online teaching, and it has become, that cliche term, the new normal.
Yeah.
So I don't think I think a lot of students won't actually be too concerned, and it won't make too much of a difference for them. But I, as well, have been so grateful for having some in-person teaching this term. So I'm going to be a bit disappointed that right towards the end of it, it's going to be cut short, because actually, a lot of the time, those last couple of weeks are really, really crucial, because you often cover the last stuff before your final exam or assessment. So, yeah, I'm a little bit concerned.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you think that we should be, due to this information, that the University of Nottingham will obviously be encouraging students to be only going home between this period, do you think that this then should encourage a sort of, I know everyone's talking about tuition fees at the moment, but do you think that this should be another indicator that students should be getting a refund of tuition fees, especially as we are being encouraged to go home before the end of term?
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with that concept. It's just not fair that we've been almost swindled out of our tuition money, expecting like a good quality level of education. And it's not only education. With university, you also have a lot of societies that you attend, but because of the national lockdown, society events have pretty much been non-existent. So I'm also paying for that, and the fact that I haven't got those services is angering me. And it's not worth the money that I'm paying whatsoever. The only thing with that is, how would we have a refund? You know, what are the technicalities of it? Is it fair to us when the year before us didn't have their graduation? Is it fair to the people ahead of us who have paid all these tuition fees and are still being forced to pay it back and everything? So while I agree with the concept, I can't actually see it manifesting.
Yeah, I feel like this is going to be on students' agenda for the rest of the year, but I think universities probably aren't going to want this travel window thing, because a lot of the reason why certain institutions have continued with the blending approach is just to meet all the clauses of an agreement, so that they aren't liable to have to reimburse students.
Right.
So I think basically the complex, I don't really know the technicalities of it, but universities are expected to uphold a certain degree of satisfaction. You know, if they've promised in-person teaching, they have to deliver it.
Right.
So I think that's why they've continued it throughout this lockdown, really. And also, you know, with everybody travelling home, I think there is a fear that maybe there is some clause that's not being met that might mean we are liable to be reimbursed. But again, I just don't know how, because this is basically a legal battle. Like, this, if we were to fight this case, this needs to be looked at by, you know, solicitors and who specialize in this area. It's not something that's going to be solved overnight with just a petition.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think I've seen like a few petitions floating around, and they don't seem to have come to anything so far, and I think I've seen someone who opened one of the petitions, I think they said that they haven't heard anything back from the Vice Chancellor. Yeah, that's just fact check that, but I think that's what I read somewhere. But I think it's definitely, it's quite a difficult, we as students are in quite a difficult position where we are paying for services that we may not be receiving, but it's practically impossible for us to sort of prove that in a way. We can't actually sort of claim that we aren't receiving everything, as we're still working, we still have online classes, we're still receiving some of the services that we would have received last year, such as like library services. But it's, we're in a very different position to what we were a year ago due to COVID, and I think that this travel home advice is quite a big statement that students are allowed to travel home between the 3rd and the 9th, and then after that it's not encouraged, because then it's quite a small window quite soon that students are being allowed to travel home.
Yeah, I agree. I also have another question for you guys. So with the class of COVID and what have you, we've also seen, well, on the one hand we have a lower quality of teaching being delivered to us for a very high price, but on the other hand we also have universities that are fining students a lot more. You know, we've heard stories where students have been fined like £10,000 and what have you. Do you think it's like justifiable that the university is putting so much pressure on these students when in fact they're not really delivering a good quality of education in the first place?
I read an article just like maybe half an hour before we started this, and it said that University of Nottingham has given out the most COVID fines to students.
Really?
Since we started. Let me see if I can find it. But we've, like, the number of COVID fines that the University of Nottingham have given out is almost, is about double of the second university amount of fines. I've just...
That makes so much sense, because my friends in Birmingham and my friends in Leeds are, like, so shocked that they even heard about fines, because they don't have that in their universities.
So the University of Nottingham has given out 608 fines.
No way.
And the second university, which is Oxford Brookes University, has only given out 340.
Whoa.
So the University of Nottingham has given out a lot of fines to students. Apparently no one's been suspended or expelled yet. They have been giving out a lot of fines.
That is crazy. 608, mad.
What is the basis for this then? Will it be sort of simple, I say simple, but you know, flouting on the sort of lower scale? Are we talking breaking rule of six? Are we talking full out breaking lockdown rules even though you're infected, and isolation rules or whatever? Or I just don't know how the uni themselves, as opposed to the police, have the authority. I don't really know how that works.
Is it because of their testing trace system?
I feel like, because I think we had to sign something or agree to something before we started this year about COVID regulations, as well as the usual sort of agreement. But it says here that 48 students have been fined for a breach of COVID regulations, and these are usually combined with antisocial behaviour fines. So this might be for sort of like the
parties,
sort of breaking the number of people in your house, house party sort of fines. But it's still, the university has been handing out a lot of fines for whatever has been.
Yeah.
I hate to say this, but then I do kind of fear that this comes down to a loss of revenue. I don't want to say, I think that first and foremost, they're using it as a deterrent, and they did know that the cases in Nottingham were so much higher than the rest of the country for a good solid 2-3 weeks.
Yeah.
But also at the same time, there's a very cynical part of me that thinks, I wonder if they're just doing this to get a bit of extra revenue, because they've lost out on a massive intake of first year students.
Yeah.
Loads less international students who, as we know, pay far more in tuition. So I hate to say it, but I wonder if this is just a bit of quick revenue for them.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. I would not be surprised.
I think that is a perfect way for them to be making some money.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Well, thanks anyway, Tamara. That was a very enlightening discussion. Thank you for joining us again for the Thursday's Pulse Show. Now we will be speaking about the EHRC inquiry into the BBC pay discrimination, how it's been branded as a whitewash. And joining me are Lilith and Tamara. So Carrie Grace has described an investigation into the pay discrimination at the BBC as a whitewash after it declared the broadcaster of doing no wrong. The former BBC China editor won substantial back pay in 2018 after going public with details of how she was out-earned by equivalent male journalists at the broadcaster. She said the methodology used by the Equality and Human Rights Commission in its investigation was baffling and said women could not rely on a regulator but should instead stay strong, calm, united and justice will prevail. The independent inquiry followed years of disputes between BBC bosses and women who claimed to be illegally underpaid compared with male colleagues, with hundreds of female employees receiving pay rises or back pay. While many BBC cases were settled through internal processes, some women were forced to take lengthy legal action. Earlier this year, for example, the BBC presenter Samira Ahmed won a £700,000 employment tribunal case against the corporation after the BBC was unable to explain why she was paid less than her male counterpart Jeremy Vine for doing equivalent work. Despite this, the EHRC concluded its 18-month investigation by saying it had found no evidence of unequal pay, having carried out an in-depth re-examination of just 10 pay complaints against the BBC. So what do you think about this inquiry? Do you think it's a whitewash? Do you think they're lying? Do you think there is some issues that they're not talking about? What do you guys think?
I think the fact that she won her case presents that there was a bit of a whitewash, and there's something here that isn't being acknowledged by the BBC, as obviously they don't want to be seen as the sort of villain in this story. But as it says, under equal pay legislation, it is illegal to pay women less than men for doing the same work. And the fact that she won the case saying that she received less pay for doing equal work shows that the BBC are still complicit in the failures when it comes to equal pay.
I agree, and I think as well, just the amount of news coverage, and this has been in the media for a long time, this is an ongoing battle, and I don't think all those, let's face it, intelligent and bright women who work for the BBC would have a reason to protest if they weren't being paid equally. And I think a lot of it comes down to just a systemic sexism within the industry. And I think it's probably so tied into the inner workings of it that, in fact, it's just going unnoticed. So I'm glad that they're actually still trying to fight it.
Yeah, I agree. And it's reading the article a bit more, you actually can see how the inquiry has failed. So it actually says that the BBC Women Group said they were disappointed with the limited nature of the investigation. So out of 1,000 complaints, I'm citing someone, the EHRC looked in depth at only 10 cases and accepted the BBC's excuse for why these were not likely to be equal pay cases. New cases are coming forward and women are still having to head to court. And so what do you think these, I guess, justifiable reasons are for paying women less? I think that they are that women work less hours, and so from that they're able to pay women less fundamentally, yeah.
I think that they may use an excuse as well, potentially, of sort of how well known the people are, because I think Jeremy Vine is quite a well known name, but I think that's still not an excuse for then paying a woman less for doing an equal amount of work, because it shouldn't be an excuse.
Yeah, and I think also it comes down to like a question of equal opportunities, because I think, as you say, a lot of women aren't as famous faces as a lot of men in the industry. And I think as well, they don't have the same opportunities. I think a lot of women have to work a lot harder to get positions high up in institutions like the BBC.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of men, I think there is a bias towards employing men. I personally want to go into the journalism industry, but it does scare me that a lot of men are given a lot more opportunities than women are. And I think as well, like Tamara said, I think there is a fear that perhaps they see women as more unreliable because perhaps they're more likely to have to go on leave, maternity leave, mm-hmm. or actually I think there's a statistic that shows women are more likely to have to take leave because of mental health problems.
Right.
But that to me all just points back to this systemic sort of sexism.
Yeah.
Why are women experiencing more mental health problems? In are they relative to their experience in a working environment? It makes you question whether it's a sort of a paradox. Are they having to take more time off because of how they're being treated at work?
Yeah.
And consequently affecting their pay?
Yeah.
I think this goes deeper than just women are being paid less than men. I think there's a more underlying systemic reason behind it. Obviously.
Yeah, I agree. And you said something important, which was that you feel, as a person who wants to go into journalism, you feel a bit more hesitant. You want to approach the BBC because of issues like this, which is a really important issue because this story is just going to have a lasting impact on younger generation and younger females and those who want to enter the journalism degree, because it's going to act as a deterrent, really, for young female journalists and broadcasters and videographers who will look to the BBC and just see, like, wage discrimination. And it's really, like, belittling and dehumanising for those young generations who actually want to enter the BBC. I was going to ask, so I don't really know much about, you know, the BBC and how their works go, but have you guys ever faced gender-based discrimination at other places you guys have worked at, whether it be, you know, pay or something outright verbal from managers or what have you?
I can't say I've ever had any issues in terms of a pay gap, but that's only because I don't think I'd be aware of it. It's not the sort of thing you go poking into, how much mm-hmm. somebody else is getting paid. And obviously, as we know, a lot of the time, it's a matter of what we were saying, people being in a higher up position. Again, a lot of men tend to lead those higher positions in a workplace.
Yeah.
I know for me, when I was working in a cafe as a young girl, as a waitress, I never even really noticed at the time, which is part of the bad thing about it.
But, yeah.
There was very much a condescending, very patronising attitude from the men who worked in the kitchen. And
yeah.
I was expected to sort of take it and have a laugh at it, maybe just like little comments, but it chips away at you and it stays with you. And now I'm older, I really wish I turned around and said something, but at the time it would never have occurred to me. But I think a lot of the time women or young girls who are going to get a part-time job or going into work, they're not taken as seriously, or they're seen as, I think that people assume that you should be able to have a joke with men in a kind of male-dominated environment. And sometimes you can't relate to the same humour, and sometimes if you can't understand or laugh at the jokes they're making, you know, I think it's just difficult because it's hard for women in some industries to actually find fellow colleagues that they can feel comfortable around.
Yeah, I
completely agree with that. I've also had, like, I've never worked in a job where it's sort of been the sort of job where I'm paid different amounts based on gender, because they've all been like student jobs as a student, but like when I worked in like a fast food restaurant, it was like the casual sexism thrown around.
Yeah,
that was quite it was always present, and you never really felt like you could say anything, just because it felt like you would be playing as part of the team, or like you just sort of had to put up with it. And I think that is a massive problem in a lot of industries.
Yeah, I agree. Speaking from my own experiences, I've never had any discrimination with regards to pay, but I've always had, you know, as you two have said, backhanded sexist compliments, and just like an environment that allows it and facilitates it to happen. Interestingly though, I worked as like I worked at a dessert place, and at that same environment, it also encouraged men to like be angrier. So when we were getting stressed out with long orders, you know, a man would just like, I don't know, be frustrated and just be a bit angry or shout or something. And none of us really said anything bad about him or scolded him whatsoever. And so you have like this double coin where on the one hand, women are being forced to like endure all these sexist comments, but on the other hand, it's also an environment which allows men to be angrier and get away with it. It's really messed up. Yeah.
100%.
So thank you to Lilith and Tamara for joining me today at the Thursday Pulse show. We've just been speaking about the EHRC inquiry, Boris Johnson's aide quitting, how we feel about the travel window, and the English test and trace system being hit by a huge IT problem last month. It's been really good to have this discussion, and I hope you all join us next week. Thank you.